Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and blessings, blessings and greetings, blessed souls. We're alive because we want to stay alive in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim, instructions of mercies. You now tune into the higher inner frequency of Blog Talk Radio. We call ourselves Soul Class, and this is Soul Class 465, Secular by Design, Part 35. Blessed is our Creator, Shalom, peace, and bracha. Blessing upon the human family experience with Creator's help. We'll be broadcasting as we are right now on April 14th. It's 9:31 here live, Eastern Standard Time, from Turtleline, a.k.a. the USA, Unifying Souls. Actually, program content will focus on, on reading Alan W. Cecil's seminal work, Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances. Meanwhile, may the Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones as we hear the end of this wonderful song by the Maccabees, Achenu, which literally means our brothers. It's also put with a parenthetical title, as well as one day more. One day more to help other human beings realize what's in store when they access their divine image. We'll help them get from the scrimmage. Uzman Kariv, in a very time that is close to us, in proximity to the time of the universal redemption. Joining me live is Rambam, teacher and student, the seminary of the teachings of Rambam, Maimonides, Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, and Nesher Gold, the great eagle, Dennis Ryan. We're reuniting after a couple weeks. Dennis, good morning to you, sir.
And the same to you, Don.
I guess in a more, how should we say, gentler time, we'd say greetings and salutations, but we have our own unique way. But as they say, there are many ways to skin the fish to make sure it gets to the tish, which is a Yiddish word for the table. And we're not dealing with fable. We're dealing with Alan W. Cecil's Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances. We're on page 73, kind of revisiting something we covered last time with Alan and Dennis. Excuse me as I take a cup of coffee. Some people say that's unprofessional. It's okay, but, you know, I like to sip that coffee to get those juices rolling. Now, Alan could not make it today in his utmost humility. He wrote to me before the program. He's driving his lovely wife of valor, Teresa Cecil, to a work. She's an RN down in Florida. And therefore, we wish the Cecils a wonderful day, and also a wonderful day for their daughter, Marlena Christensen, and her husband as well. Now, let's go right into the reading, and of course we'll be turning to Dennis for points of comments, criticisms, and concerns, and we'll all be the wiser to hear Dennis's feedback. During the late 18th century, the British pushed off the indigenous peoples, mainly the Kikuyu, off the island they had lived in for centuries. We're talking about off the African continent. And by World War II, over 30,000 British settlers were living off the fat of the Kenyan land, the land of Kenya, producing cash crops such as coffee and tea. The colony that was embedded within Kenya became even more important when India threw off the British imperial yoke, which I guess was in the 1940s. And Kenya became the new jewel in the rapidly tarnishing British crown, which was actually rapidly going down. Of course, the ungrateful Kikuyu were becoming disgruntled about the recipients of, we're going back to again, that philosopher John Stuart Mill's greatest happiness principle, which of course meant the greatest happiness for the white British who had taken the best arable land and resettled the Kikuyu into reserves or reservations, much as the European Americans forced the Native Americans onto reservations during the 19th century. As conditions in the reserves deteriorated because of overcrowding, the Kikuyu's anger reached critical mass, turning into an armed rebellion known as the Mau Mau War. The worldwide press at the time was wholly sympathetic to the brave British settlers who were defending themselves against the onslaught of the brutal and savage Mawa, who I guess became brutal and savage because their land had been taken from them in an unjust manner. It was many decades later when a much different picture began to develop, mainly due to the work of Harvard professor Carolyn Elkins. Now, Elkins had spent many years in Africa interviewing the Kikuyu and trying to uncover the truth about Mau Mau War and its aftermath. Dennis, do you recall in your studies of the 20th century of such a conflict and how the British were promoted as the valiant ones and the Kikuyu tribe or nation were relegated to the titles of being brutal and unsympathetic to the rapidly fading imperial empire of the British island?
Well, the British had the idea that all these people were waiting to serve them. So right. Therefore, they did this colonization, but they did it so they could bring back riches, money, back to good old England. But at the expense of who and what? And they justified it by saying their government and their God was behind them, and it was for the betterment of all humanity. Wow, they got away with a lot of crap, Don.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I look at the word colonial, and the word cologne usually gives a pleasant smell, Dennis, but this is a pretty... Something doesn't stink in the state of Denmark. It stunk in the state of 20th century and 19th century and 18th century and 17th century England as they were, as what did they say, they were the empire where the sun never sets. The sun never sets on the British Empire. Well, I would say all praise to the Creator that such an empire has seen its sunset, even though they still obviously still maintain a certain importance in the world. We're not out to insult the British people as much as we're, you know, in the Tanakh, the nation of Israel is harshly criticized by the prophets when we engage in inequity. So all's fair in the human affairs of the human family experience, Dennis, where no one is beyond criticism when they need to be criticized. Your take on that?
That's correct, Don, but you got to remember that justification was buried in pomp and circumstance, and they had God behind them because their government and their religion, Anglicism, were all one together. So therefore, they were unified in their purpose, and the poor people were just steamrolled all over the place. I mean, you even mentioned India before. They ruled India through the East India Trading Company for almost three, four centuries, I forget how long. But they used that as an excuse that the people should fall in line because they're really trying to help them out economically. And what they did was they made sure the poor people stayed poor and any riches that were developed were shipped back to England. How nice.
Mm-hmm. Now we're going to turn to footnote 24 on page 72 of Secular by Design in the section called Protocols of the Philosopher, and I guess the subtitle of this section is also called, as we turn back a couple of pages, The Dark Side of Enlightenment. And we'll be plucking from Maya Green's Mama Oathing Rituals and Political Ideology in Kenya, a reanalysis, Journal of the International African Institute, volume 60, number 1, published in 1990, page 70. And here it goes. At the beginning of the 20th century, the completion of the Uganda Railway opened up the interior of Kenya for commercial exploitation. British government policy was to establish a settler economy, same thing, economy for the colony, capable of exporting produce in a quantity sufficient to justify high levels of investment, while at the same time ensuring that the indigenous population shared the financial burden of colonial government. To this end, by 1914, a system of African reserves with fixed boundaries were demarcated, together with the exclusive area of fertile land for European farming. The White Highlands stretched westwards from Nairobi along the Rift Valley. The high altitude renders the climate suitable for a variety of crops, such as tea in particular, coffee, and wheat. The introduction of hut taxation and the registration of adult males under the Kipandi Pass Law system was a double measure explicitly designed to raise revenue and force African participation in the labor market. African farmers were prevented legally from growing cash crops. This restriction consolidated the structural prerequisites for a dual economy premised on the reserves as a source of labor rather than produce. And again, that's from Maya Green's Mau Mau Oathing Rituals and Political Ideology in Kenya, a reanalysis. Now, Dennis, you know, this whole idea that each hut was taxed, I guess, which each family or extended family lived in, is kind of like a different take on the American hut, which is usually a cadence before the footballer snapped to the quarterback. But here, the quarterback here was the British colonial economic exploitative system. And, you know, it doesn't surprise me, as we now look into the 20th century and the 21st century and the latter part of the 20th century, no wonder why these African countries would want to go and seek communist ideologies, because they were so exploited by these supposed capitalist ventures, which are actually systems of exploitation. Your take on this, Dennis?
Yes, it was all exploitation, but what happens is the people who were being exploited didn't realize it, because it was like a way of life. That's how the English presented it. They tried it on us. They created a stamp tax in the United States, but when they went to a tea tax, the Americans at the time said, "That's enough. We're not going to strangle ourselves, because we all love tea. Most of us came from England and we drank tea." So now they were going to the heart of the matter, and we said, "We're going to fight." Now, these other places, the English made sure that they couldn't unite. It sort of squeezed them. It put them in shoeboxes because they got diamonds from South America. The Central Africa was all mining from Kenya to Rhodesia at the time. And they just wanted to control anything. So any value that was there was considered prime prospects for English exploitation. Now, it isn't the English people that are bad. It was the government and the reason that they told everybody. But from a publicity viewpoint, they wanted to look like the injured party. So when you started talking about the Mau Maus, everybody said, "What? Savages killing white people? Oh, my God." So all of a sudden, things fell into place for the English.
Yeah. Go, continuing on with the book, Dennis, and blessed souls listening out there. And again, if anyone wants, we still have about 15 minutes to go on the program. Our number to call in if you want to listen and maybe even make a contribution towards our dialogue today is 347-838-8669. Continuing further into Alan's book, the attitude of the British towards the Kikuyu was not only based on religious attitudes, as Dennis just mentioned, and we're now quoting from page 75 from the book of Maya Green's Mau Mau Oathing Rituals and Political Ideology in Kenya, a reanalysis. The church never completely lost its association with colonial power. The expulsion of Gikuyu Christians from mission schools and churches in the 1930s, in opposition to the practice of clitorectomy, of girls' initiation, encouraged a perception of Gikuyu tradition and religion as objectifiable and valid entities. And for those who are not familiar with the clitoridectomy, this is something which has gotten a lot of publicity in the last several years, as the Zion efforts of women who are not Christian but are actually Muslim have come out to spoke how they had sort of like a female circumcision, in which by them getting it at a raw young age, I don't remember the age ranges, I think from single digits to when they're like 11 or 12 years old, they not only are basically, their bodies are violated by this act of removing of their clitoris, but as well, they are denied the right to, we have to be frank about it, blessed souls, certain pleasure that's connected to that when man and woman become of one flesh. So this was something that was probably more ingrained within the African traditions that just sort of morphed into whether it be Christianity and has been given a lot of publicity in the media in the last several years into those who promote the Islamic tradition, although the Muslims of the Middle East, meaning the Arabic peoples, as to my knowledge, do not practice such matters. And I just want to mention from a Torah perspective, blessed souls, there is no such thing as a circumcision for the woman because she's considered to be born fully rectified. For the male, whether he be a Jew at the age of 8 days, if he's healthy enough, or if someone wants to convert, it's a matter of rectification. So for whatever reason, somewhere in that African tradition, it became something which became like a statute and then integrated into Christianity and to the Islam faith. But I just want to mention that, I mean, personally for me, it's horrifying because from a Torah perspective, the woman, any woman, Jewish woman or one of the children of the daughters of Noah, women are born completely rectified. It says we men, for those of who want to, for those who have to, for Jews or those who want to, the children of Noah, it's something that is something upon us, again, depending on what your faith is. But it's just interesting how that this matter he brings up, and I just thought I would bring that up as just a counter response, that although a woman, I think if she's going to do that, Dennis, should be doing it of her own volition and not to be forced into it to the point where her body is literally violated. And I think it's a lot of these ceremonies, they're not even given anesthesia at the time of this, I would call this the, maybe I'm being ethnocentric, the violation of their bodies.
It certainly was, Don. And the English, though, were clever in the sense that they practiced on the Irish for a long time, and now they wanted to extend their control over all these other countries. And the first thing they do is make sure you don't have enough food, or food is very scarce. So by doing that, you're dependent on them. The other thing is that they always try to do is cut down on the birth rate. Because if they're always worried about these other countries that they controlled, that it would get out of hand. So any technique that was used, even disfigurement of women's private parts, was included in the thing because it was an old tribal practice. So rather than teach him about the religion they practiced in England, they went along with any local tribal aspects or concepts that the English thought would only help them out. So here they are trying to control people and the food they eat. And for a long time they were successful till people finally said, enough is enough.
Mm-hmm. Right. And going further, again, we just gave a perspective of the religious involvement, the part of the Church of England, the Anglican Church, I think, as Dennis mentioned before, that it wasn't just religious attitudes where the British put their nose up into the air and looked down on the Kikuyu, but as Alan continued, but on the enlightened views of reason and science that whites, particularly jolly old Englishmen, were physically and intellectually superior to non-whites, and that, quote-unquote, quoting from John Lonsdale, Mau Mau's of the Mind, Making Mau Mau and Remaking Kenya, which was published in the Journey of African History, Volume 31, Number 3, published in 1990, page 401. But to profit by Africans, it seemed that whites must subvert them. On entering Kenya, therefore, settlers also entered a 19th century South African debate on how to construct political security and morality on shifting sands. It was never resolved whether in white opinion or in the priorities of the colonial state. Conservatives, on one hand, thought Africans inherently primitive. The liberals thought that they were retarded children, however, who promised well as modern men. So then, as we see here, that it wasn't just an ethnocentric or a religious-centric viewpoint. It was also a philosophical or socializing or a sociological ethnocentric perspective, where on the right side of the coin, they thought the Africans were primitive. On the left side, so to speak, they thought they were retarded. How witty and brilliant and so open-minded these secular reason people were in their closed-mindedness. Dennis?
Well, underneath it all, they treated everybody who was non-white as some type of a savage that had to be put up with and controlled because they didn't know what they were doing. But they didn't want to educate them. They didn't even want to give them any type of religion to follow. They left them there without any thoughts, and now they're paying for it. And the worst problem ever happened was in Nigeria, and we're living with that today. What happened was one half of the country was Christian, the other half was Muslim. Between them, there was a river. Now, instead of making the river one side of the country and the other, they just, that was east and west, they went ahead and put everybody together, which for centuries, they didn't get along together because the river was a physical separation. So here they are trying to mess up people's minds, and they did a good job. And we'll forever have to deal with this problem in Nigeria. Sad. Very sad.
Very, very sad. And again, it just you know, it really goes back, Dennis, to that ancient biblical teaching about Cain and Abel, where Abel was able to see that there was enough for everyone, and Cain thought not. Therefore, he came up with this unfortunate lower end of human consciousness called jealousy and anger, and we know what the outcome of that was. So reading a little bit further into the book of Alan's on page 72, as we get to the bottom part of it, the Kikuyu naturally resented this attitude. And now we're going to be quoting from, again, Maya Green's Mau Mau Oathing Rituals and Political Ideology in Kenya, reanalysis, page 72. A wave of armed robberies, assassinations, and government chiefs, and increasing paranoia on the part of the European community led to the declaration of a state of emergency in October 1952. I'm sure the Kikau, blessed souls, also declared a state of emergency once they were invaded by the colonizers. But going further into the book, almost 100,000 squatters were repatriated en masse to the reserves. Central province was closed for 7 years, and British armed forces were brought in to suppress a revolt, which in fact the emergency had precipitated. As the British took on, it was going to page 73, as the British took on the white man's burden in Kenya, and now we're quoting from Nationalism, Ethnicity, and Modernity, The Paradox of Mau Mau, Canadian Journal of African Studies, the Canadian Review, in the, I guess, the African Attitudes, Volume 25, Number 2, published in 1991, page 182. In the most coherent official version, Mau Mau, of course, under the British ethnocentric, ethno-cultural, ethno-religious, ethno-philosophical viewpoint, was depicted as savage, violent, and a deprived tribal cult, an expression of unrestrained emotion rather than reason. It sought to turn the Kikuyu people back to the battle days before enlightened British rule had brought the blessings of modern civilization and development. Yeah, like the modern civilized hut tax. With that being said, many of the Kikuyu decided they had enough of British imperialism and decided to fight for their land, and many secretly took the Mau Mau Oath, which revolved around two important aspects that Americans should recognize as certain unalienable rights. I wonder where I've heard that, Dennis. I think it's in the Declaration of Independence. So, my golly gee, the Kikaus would have believed in the American independence because they believed they had certain unalienable rights for land and freedom. The Mau Mau were simply the Kikuyu who had armed themselves with machetes and clubs against the better armed and organized British veterans of the Second World War. And after hacking a few white settlers to pieces, the rebellion was quickly put down by the British. The disparity in death is striking. One official piece of data, Mau Mau are African, so described, lost 12,590 dead in action or by hanging over 4.5 active years of war. 164 troops of police died in the same period, most of them Africans. Mau Mau killed almost 1,900 civilians. Nearly a third of them KG, and all but 58 of them black. So, Dennis, we see here that the chaos created by the British led to, we're talking about over 14,000 people dying in 4.5 years in the name of civilizing the savages.
It was a lot more than that. That's all they counted. They couldn't count them all. But you must remember, in Africa, every country where the British withdrew eventually, it left turmoil in their aftermath, because these people were mad. But the British had already left, so they started fighting among themselves. And this fighting's been going on and still going on in the continent of Africa. Wow. You also got to remember that when they controlled Canada, England, they just plowed under all the Indians. And that's what happened to us in this country. Most of the people that came from England as immigrants to the United States had this burning, this British burning in their stomach that said, we have to get rid of these savages, the Indians. So we took them as being bad guys, and they had to get out of our way so we could take whatever they had. So they felt deprived and they rebelled. Wouldn't all humans rebel if you're living a normal life and all of a sudden somebody pushes their way and imposes their thinking, their religion on top of you? So when you get a chance, you come out swinging. And that's what humans do.
True. I once saw a poster, Dennis. It showed a picture of Native American Indians with shotguns in their hands standing, you know, defiantly. And underneath it, there was the lettering, World War I started in 1620. For them, it was World War I, because the world was warring against them, namely the European world. Dennis, with that being said, we've come actually to the end of, I think, was a very potent presentation. I thank you very much for your utilizing one of your most valuable resources, your blessed and precious time. Before we leave the airwaves today, Dennis, is there some nugget of wisdom you'd like to share with the blessed souls listening out there live, or in the future we'll hear your comments on the archive version of today's program?
Yes, if you don't like something and you hate what's going on, it doesn't mean you can go ahead and kill and justify what you're doing. We must get over our hate. So you can't get over your hate unless you put it in your back pocket and be more tolerant.
Amen. And I'd like to end off, blessed souls, by reminding everyone that I'm plucking from a teaching from someone at work called Hayom Yom, which was published 72 years ago. And it talks about how each person has an individual task in this world, which is corresponding to his or her character and innate qualities. There can be one who can drill pearls or polish gems, but works instead on baking bread. Though baking bread is the most necessary craft and occupation, this person is considered to not fulfilling all the human potential. So I'd like to suggest this to you, blessed souls, before we segue out of the show with some music by Yosef Kaduner, singing a song of ascents from Psalms 121, that we're all just baking bread allegorically if we forget about the pearls of our divine image, which every human being is blessed with and anointed with. There's not any human being was ever born without a divine image, because if that person was born without a divine image, then they're not a person. There's something else, which I don't know what they would be called otherwise. So with that being said, I'd like to read the words to the lyrics that Yosef Kaduner is about to sing to us in Hebrew, so you'll get an idea of because it's very heartfelt sounding music, which will be playing throughout this period for about the next 39 days until we get to the celebration of the 3,327th time Israel is accepting the Torah, which is embodied in the Ten Commandments, which I'm sure many millions, if not billions of people around the world are also willing to accept, with all these 613 commandments if you're a Jew, and the seven universal commandments if you're one of the blessed children of Noah. But here are the words, a song for a sense. I shall raise my eyes to the mountains, from where will my help come? My help is from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not allow your foot to falter. Your guardian will not slumber. Behold, the guardian of Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your guardian. The Lord is your shadow. He is by your right hand. By day the sun will not smite you, nor the moon at night. The Lord will guard you from all evil. He will guard your soul. The Lord will guard your going out and your coming from now into eternity. And we'll be ending the show right now. Blessed souls, open the way of Ahav Echad, one love. Goral Echad, one destiny kolano for all of us. Badar chinom l'ok shalom. Pleasant and peaceful way. And just remember, Teva Tov L'Heitiv is nature of the good to do good. And the Creator is the source of all good. That's the big secret, blessed souls, you should know. So although we might have ambivalence, what we should do, good or bad, Don't worry, it's in your DNA because you've got that divine image. Will help you get on scrimmage to realize your Tehillim Elokim is no dream. And here we go, leaving off with Yosef Kanur Shir Malot, Song of Ascent, Psalms 121. Take care, everyone.
Shir Lamalot Esa Einai El Harim Me'ayin Yavo Ezri Ezri Me'im Hashem Ose Shamayim Va'aret Aliten Lamot Raglecha Aryanum Shomrecha הנה לא ינום, ינום, ולא ישן, שומר ישראל. השם שומרך, השם צילך, על יד ימינך. יומם השמש לא יקקה, וירח בלילה. השם ישמורך מכל רע, ישמור את נפשך. השם ישמור צאתך ובואך מעתה ועד עולם. שיר למעלה אשא עיני אל הערים מאין יבוא עזרי. עזרי מעם השם עושה ולא ישן שומר ישראל. השם שומרך, השם צילך, על יד ימינך. יומם השמש לא יקקה, וירח בלילה. השם ישמורך מכל רע, ישמור את נפשך. השם ישמור צאתך ובואך מעתה ועד עולם. השם שומרך, השם צילך, על יד ימינך. יומם השמש לא יקקה, וירח בלילה. השם ישמורך מכל רע, ישמור את נפשך. השם ישמור צאתך ובואך, ואתה ועד עולם. השם ישמור צאתך ובואך מעתה ועד עולם.